leave it. So I'm not questioning that Jesus said that. I'm asking, why would he put the amount in? Now, sometimes you can figure it out, sometimes you can't. But often, those little details that don't seem really to matter much become his way of hooking onto an earlier passage from his Bible. And I think that's very much the case here, and we'll consider that. Now, as a starter, let me ask you a question. And I was thinking I was going to ask Esther this morning, and we were busy hustling around trying to be ready. How many of you have baked bread from scratch, or seen it done at least? From scratch, no machines, by hand. Okay, so most of you, quite a few of you have done that. Good, that will be a little bit of the background. So come with me, let's take a look at the story. Why do I need to know that it was three measures? In order to figure that out, we have to go to a very different time and place. So come with me from Jesus' time, about the turn of the millennium. He was probably born about 6 BC. And let's go, let's say, 1,700 years earlier. Now, the land of Israel is largely desert. If we make this particular piece the land that God promised Abraham, and then later the Israelites got it, and today it's called political Israel, about 70% of that land is desert. There's the Sinai Desert, there's the wilderness of Tzin, there's the Negev Desert, and there's the Judah Wilderness. So a great deal of that early Bible story is really desert story. People don't pick up on that because we assume it's the land flowing with milk and honey. It must look a little bit like Northwest Iowa or Hawaii or something. When in fact, about 70% of it looks like this. So if you come with me in your mind, we're 1,700 years before Jesus. We're about 150 miles south of anywhere he's ever placed in his lifetime. And we're out in the desert. Believe it or not, in this dusty, unbelievably barren area, people actually live. Not a lot of them, but nomadic people live in that desert as they did 1,700 years before Jesus. Usually their occupation has to do with shepherding. I love to take groups. We get off the bus and we start our hike, and inevitably, if I pick it right or God is in it, we'll run across a flock of sheep. And you have to see a busload of Americans who suddenly discover that sheep can live in that desert. And people are just stunned. It's funny. It happens every single time. That group will stand there for 5 minutes just trying to figure out how in the world those sheep can survive in this barren land. Anyway, it's in that context I need to take you this morning. And in that context, there was an elderly couple who lived in tents, very much the way the Bedouin, the nomadic Bedouin do today. The man's name was Abraham, like this man is named Ibrahim, and his wife's name was Sarah. Now, one day, as Abraham was sitting in the tent in the heat of the day, God showed up in the form of three strangers. As he was sitting in the tent in the heat of the day, he looked up and saw three men. Now, you're given an insight that he doesn't have. You're told that those three strangers, what look like three ordinary people, he's never seen them before, otherwise they wouldn't be strangers. And I assume he probably thought, I'll never see them again, they're just passing by. Those three strangers are two angels in human form and God. Probably Jesus, because when God shows up in human form, it's Jesus. So it's probably Jesus and two angels. You don't know that for sure, but probably. He doesn't know that. So we're going to discover how two nomadic people living in this barren wasteland respond when three strangers show up. Now, the first thing that it says is let me try something once here. I didn't hook up the audio this morning, but let me see if you would expect, You would expect hospitality. I've been there more than 250 times with groups of people, and I've never been treated in any other way by the Muslim people that we've interacted with great compassion and love and concern. Never had a negative experience in all my time there. So we know that if Abraham is part of that Middle Eastern culture, you're going to find hospitality. So come with me a moment. Let me show you one of those times in our experience. Let me see if I can get this thing to...
His name is Mohammed. I've met him before. Ethelhabite. Yeah. Okay. He lives over on that side, somewhere some miles away. Kama. 150. And you're looking at David. I'm telling you, you're looking at David. You're looking at Joseph's brothers. We make them 50-year-old men. Now, watch this. Think about what you're carrying in your wallet right now. Okay, now watch this. This is all this kid has for the whole day. Shukran, my friend, shukran. I tell you, he just gave you his lunch. Come on, it would be a huge insult. Let's break bread. Here's the way to do it. You rip off a piece and then pass it to the next.
That's all that kid had, turned out for 2 days, and he just gave it away. Just on the spur of the moment, you got a group of Americans there with their packs. Everybody's got 26 power bars and paydays and all kinds of health things to eat and food. And this kid gave us every single bit of bread that he had just as a way to say, welcome to my place. And that's Middle Eastern. So God chose a group of people, the Jews, for whom that kind of hospitality came naturally. I don't think he would have picked people out of our culture because I don't think they would have had the same level of hospitality. But the writer wants to show you that Abraham and Sarah were extraordinary in their hospitality. So the fact that they would care for these three strangers without knowing they were two angels and God doesn't surprise anybody in the Middle East. That's the way they live. The question would be, how do you make Abraham above and beyond what his culture is? Well, the writer does it in 6 ways. So join the story. First, it says, when Abraham saw them, he ran to meet them. In fact, twice the Hebrew says Abraham ran, and once the Hebrew says Abraham hurried. And actually, you could translate that if you want to be colloquial and say Abraham jogged. Now, nobody gasped. I don't see anybody shaking your head. I don't see anybody's mouth hanging open. In the Middle East, old men do not run. Ever. It is culturally absolutely shameful. I have never, in all my years there and all my interaction with elderly people, I have never seen an old man in a robe run. I've seen a woman, what passed for running at least, when sheep were getting in an inappropriate place. I have never seen a man run. I don't even know how to describe to you. It would shame the man, it would shame the family. It would shame the whole village if a man ran. You don't do it. It's absolutely inappropriate. In fact, if you think about it, there are three people, old men, in the Bible who run. Can you tell me who they are? This one, obviously, Abraham, so that's one. The father of the prodigal son. And you get how powerful that story was in Jesus' mind. That father wants his son back so badly that the father will run. That people gasp when you tell that story in the Middle Eastern context. He ran in front of the community. Wow, did he's willing to be shamed in order to get his son back. Who's the third? People want to say Elijah. You could be right. Then there's four. We don't know how old Elijah was. Doesn't say in the Bible. Some people think he was old. Some people think he was young. He just shows up full grown, doesn't say anything about his childhood or how old he was or how old when he died. So if Elijah is old, then he's the fourth to, or the third to run. The fourth would be Esau. when Jacob came to meet Esau, Esau ran. Should have been the other way. Jacob was the one who cheated his brother. He should have been shaming himself in humility, but Esau is willing to humble himself, and I think Jesus uses that story too in another place. Now, I don't know how to describe to you how powerful that is in the Middle East. I have a friend, his name is Faraj, and Faraj works as our guide in the Sinai. This is Faraj on my right. Faraj's father is the sheikh of the Jabalia tribe. That's the tribe of nomadic people who live around the traditional Mount Sinai. Faraj will be the sheikh, or I haven't seen him in a few years, so he may be the sheikh now. I don't know if his father has passed away. They're pretty well outside of communication. But I was sitting in the tent with Faraj and with his father, the sheikh. This is his father on the right and his father's youngest daughter on the left. And we were sitting in the tent, and I'm stewing because I love this Middle Eastern stuff so much. And I had been taught and I had observed myself that old men don't run. So I wanted to know, would this guy run? But you can't ask him that because it's shameful. It would be like you sitting in your family room. This is what I tell students so you can laugh, and if you think it's inappropriate, I'm sorry. And your 88-year-old grandmother walks through the room half-dressed. And you'd hustle her out of there in a big hurry. It's like, come on, you know, grandma, whatever. So you can't say to somebody's grandma, would you walk through the room half-dressed in front of guests? That would be offensive. So I can't ask him. I can't say to him, would you run? So what do I do? So finally I thought, I know what I'll do. I'll ask Faraj to ask him. So I went into this big thing with Faraj, and I said, you realize I'm an American. I'm of a different religion than you. I'm from a different place and culture. And you know, I don't know a lot about you and how you are. I don't want to offend you, but I want to ask you something. Would El Khalil, I called his father El Khalil, which they like because that's the term Muslims use for Abraham, means our honored father, El Khalil. I said, would El Khalil run? And I could see from Faraj's face that that was not a question he was real comfortable with. He didn't smile. And Faraj, Esther be my witness, is this friendly, always cheerful, always positive, low-key, but I could tell. So he thought for a moment, and then he talked to his dad for like 10 minutes, it seemed. And I'm thinking, oh my word, he's telling me, don't worry, this guy's going to leave in a short time. He hasn't got all his oars in the water. He's one short of a six-pack. He doesn't know what he's talking about, just humor. I don't know what he said. His father sat, never even looked at me, just looked straight ahead, just dead serious. And after what seemed like an eternity, his father said in Arabic, Mavruk Labakshish, something like that. And it wasn't those words, but something about that. And I'm thinking, oh, he said, where's the big knife? Somebody get me the big knife. Whatever. And Faraj grinned. And I said, Faraj, what did he say? And he said, my father said, is a black scorpion about to bite my granddaughter? Those are the poisonous ones. And that was his answer. I think what he said was, I'd run to save my granddaughter's life. Don't ask again. Old men don't run. But when the ancestors of Jesus see three strangers wandering through their back 40, their instant reaction, or at least Abraham's instant reaction, was to run way beyond what you expect culturally. What would you do if you saw a group of Arabic-looking people with keffiyehs on wandering in your backyard? Would you run to invite them in? Anyway, second, why was Abraham sitting in the tent in the heat of the day? One at a time, please. Why was Abraham sitting in the tent in the heat of the day? He had just been circumcised. So he's in serious discomfort. Let's just leave it there. So he runs, not only as an old man, but he runs to his own personal discomfort. Now, this is the first example in the Bible of where God visits the sick, or where someone is sick and God visits. So the Jews take this to say, What God does when someone's sick is what you should do when someone's sick. Don't mention that God told him to be circumcised, so he kind of made him sick. But God goes to visit Abraham. So now we got a second thing. Not only does Abraham run as an old man, which is countercultural, Abraham runs in personal discomfort. And then it says he oversaw, he didn't actually participate, but he oversaw the foot washing of these three guests whom he didn't know. That too is countercultural, because in this culture, I had to pay this guy $20 to draw a bucket of water out of a cistern. Men don't do the water thing. That's always a woman's job. If guests show up, the woman is going to wash feet. That's always the way it was and always the way it is. But Abraham wanted to be part of the hospitality so much that he acted counterculturally. Third, it says Abraham ran, and we already talked about that, and selected a choice, tender, my English says calf. That's really not what the word means. The word means a young, an offspring of a farm animal. Could be a calf, could be a lamb, could be a baby goat. Any farm animal would fit the term calf. Now, in the culture, you almost never eat meat. They'll keep a few sheep nearby that don't get tough and stringy wandering in those hills for special occasions. And in biblical times, as it is today, special occasions usually mean things like a wedding, the birth of a child, or a religious festival. So my friend Faraj, their family has meat about four times a year unless someone marries in the family. So meat is unheard of. If you kill an animal, you have no way to preserve it in ancient time and in a lot of places to this day. So you don't kill the animal if you don't have enough people there to eat the whole thing. So Abraham prepares meat, which is only done on very, very special occasions. That's number four. I was going to tell you stories about all these. Then he said to Sarah, number five, go get the finest flour. Now, in the Middle East, in their day, it's a little bit different today. In the Middle East, in their day, there were two types of flour that were widely used. The poor used barley flour, and the rich used wheat flour. Barley was a hardier grain. It was not as nice to process. It got those little hulls in it, and it didn't, for them at least, make as good a bread in their mind. So if you were poor, you had barley because you couldn't risk the barley being eaten by grasshoppers. I'm sorry. You couldn't risk the wheat being eaten by grasshoppers or the fungus that the wheat in the Middle East gets. So you would eat barley. If you were rich, barley like this. If you were rich, you could afford to eat wheat flour. Now, Abraham is rich, I understand that, but it's unheard of in that cultural setting to serve wheat flour to a guest. If you show up as a guest, you expect to be served. That's hospitality. You don't expect to be served the finest flour. I heard one rabbi one time say that he had been in France and he had bought a $1,200 bottle of wine for the celebration of their 50th wedding anniversary. I guarantee you, if I had come as a guest to that rabbi's house, I was not going to get that $1,200 bottle of wine. I was going to get the ripple, even though I was going to be welcomed. So Abraham says, let's serve them the very best. So we got three total strangers, people he's never seen before, assume he never thinks he'll see them again. He runs, even though it's shameful, even though he's in pain. He oversees or participates in foot washing, which is completely outside the cultural norm. He serves meat, which is unheard of. And then he instructs Sarah, and he and Sarah are going to prepare the meal with the finest flour, which is also unheard of. Now, the fifth, I'm losing my numbers here, the fifth countercultural thing is also present. Let me show you a moment. Oops.
in the culture is
where our custom might be, and I don't know how you all practice this, but I know for Esther, for example, if we invite guests to come over to eat, she likes to have everything ready. So when the doorbell rings, you welcome them in, you maybe spend a short time in conversation, maybe a bit of hors d'oeuvre of some kind or another, and then we sit down to eat. In the Middle East, when you're invited, you start from scratch, and you're expected to sit and watch the process from the very beginning of where the flour is poured, the little bit of dough that has yeast in it is mixed, the water and salt are mixed, and it's kneaded, and then it rises a little bit, and you just sit. And the idea is serving is such an important part of the culture that you want to have the people you're serving observe your service. So it isn't you prepare for 2 hours before they get there. You want them to see that preparation so that they know how devoted you are to caring about someone, a guest, a stranger, or someone you know really well. So Abraham and Sarah must have done the same thing. They prepared the meal. But once that first bread is prepared, and I'm not going to show this whole piece, but let me just show you a little bit of it, if I may. This one didn't have, we didn't put the musical score on here, but. That's pita, by the way. You buy pita at Meijer's, but that's not real pita. This is real pita. This is the way pita. That's the loaf that the Bible describes as loaves. Now, notice he gets the first piece, always. And it's partly to honor the sheikh, the patriarch of the family. So the oldest male takes some first. Then he will serve everyone else, and he'll wait to eat until everyone else has eaten. But if you look at the story, Abraham is countercultural. Because it says, Abraham and Sarah stood nearby while they ate. So in this case, Abraham wouldn't even, as patriarch, as the head of the family, Abraham wouldn't eat ahead of his guests, probably because he wanted the guests to understand that they're more important than he is. So now we've got, in the culture, someone who runs counterculturally, even when they're in pain and discomfort. They participate in foot washing, which is never a man's job. They serve meat. They serve finest flour. And they will not eat, either one of them, particularly Abraham here as the patriarch, until the guests have eaten. So in every way, they've gone above and beyond what the culture expects. But the writer isn't satisfied. We assume the writer is Moses. He wants you to understand that Abraham and Sarah are not simply hospitable as our ancestors. Abraham and Sarah are hospitable way beyond the cultural norm as our ancestors. Hence, we ought to be like them. So the text says, get 3 seahs of flour. Now, let me see the show of hands again of those of you that have baked bread or observed it from scratch. Okay? Raise them like you're proud of it. There you go. That's good. I'd love to be invited over for some fresh bread someday. I love fresh bread. Anyway, raise them again. I need to pick someone. Okay. I need somebody who's done it from scratch. Zena. Okay, how many loaves did you make? Just one at a time. How much flour would it take to make a loaf of bread? 2 cups, okay, which is what? 1/2 pound, 1/4 pound? Abraham said, Sarah, get me 3 seahs. You know how much 3 seahs is? 3 seahs. Is 50 to 75. I usually say 65 because I like the ring of 65. But somewhere, depending whether it's an Egyptian seah or a Phoenician seah, it's 50 to 75 pounds. Now, Zena, how long would it have taken you to turn 65 pounds of flour into bread? I mean, the rabbis looked at this and they said, this is miraculous because there's no way a woman would be able to even knead 65 pounds of flour, because you have to put a little bit of yeast in. They let it rise for an hour or so. You put salt in, you put water in, it all has to be mixed, and it has to be kneaded, and then it has to be turned into those little bun-like things that they spread up. You couldn't do that in one day. God gave her miraculous power, the rabbis believe. Now, I don't know if that's true or not, but at least understand, she baked enough bread for these three total strangers to last them for 6 months. That's how our ancestors took care of strangers, the writer says. That's the kind of people God chose to be his community. Because you see, when you act this way in the name of God, you make God look really good. If that's the kind of people this God wants, if that's the kind of people this God molds and shapes, that may be the God I want to be part of. Now, what does that have to do with Jesus? Well, Abraham and Sarah, Abraham ran, he washed feet, he prepared meat, he served finest flour, he waited to eat, and he and Sarah prepared three sayas. Now watch what Jesus did. Jesus, it says, told another parable. The kingdom of heaven, what I came to create, what I came to institute, what I came to develop, the program I came to bring, what I want from Hamilton CRC, what I want from every person who claims to follow Jesus, what I want for those children at release time, I want them to realize the kingdom of heaven is like yeast that a woman took and mixed with three sayas of flour. And his whole audience said, ah, I know where he got that. He's saying the Abraham and Sarah story is what it looks like if you follow Jesus. Now, I'd make a couple suggestions. One, just very practical as a teacher. Because we don't ask the question, is Jesus drawing on a Bible passage? Unless he quotes it. Most of us read right past these. Three sayas, who cares? We don't even want to know what a saya is, so translate it three measures. It's easier. If you learn to ask the question, why do I need to know that little detail? And then begin to investigate, does three sayas show up anywhere else in the Bible? You may discover Jesus is bringing a whole lot more content into the teaching he's giving than what initially meets the eye. You remember the story of Ruth? Moabite? I mean, absolute disgusting pagan to a Jew? The worst illegals to a Jew? She marries into a Jewish family. Her husband dies. Her father-in-law dies. Her brother-in-law dies. And she's got no connection to the family Beit Av, the family household. She and her bitter mother-in-law head back to nothing, to live in a cave. And her mother-in-law says, Ruth, it's harvest. We got nothing. We're hungry. Go down, and you'll notice in the field of any righteous person, there's going to be some grain left uncut. Go harvest it. And she said, no, they'll kill me, I'm guessing. No, they won't. They won't. They let Moabites harvest their corners? Uh-huh. What kind of a God do you have? So she heads out, and she's gleaning. And this Boaz guy sees her in a distance, and he says to some of the other guys who are working in the field, who is this? And they said, she's a Moabite. A Moabite? Yeah. But she's the daughter-in-law of Ruth, of Naomi. Really? And so Boaz approached her. He put the corner of his robe with the tassel on it over her shoulder and said, God will protect you, you illegal immigrant. God will provide sanctuary. Hold out your apron. And he poured fresh grain, wheat no less, wheat, into her apron. Guess how much? Say 3 seahs. Understand what God's people look like? To a broken world where it's every man for himself, I'll protect mine, this is mine, I earned it, God gave it to me, you leave it alone. In God's family, you ask, how can I put God on display? By being counterculturally hospitable. And so the kingdom of heaven looks like Abraham and Sarah. It looks like Boaz and Ruth. There's a short letter. People debate how authentic it is. Most scholars think it at least contains a kernel of truth. There's a letter that exists. It's in the museum in the Vatican. It was written in the 2nd century, just as the church was beginning. Church is only 100 years old yet. And it's written by a pagan who is watching these house churches grow. And he's describing what they're like. He's got very complimentary things to say. He thinks they're weird, but he's describing them. And then he has this at the end. He says, many of the, and I'll use the word pagan. He has a different word. I would have to explain it. But he means many of us idol worshipers are drawn to this community because they care about us, only to discover we were really drawn to their God and his son Jesus. Wouldn't it be cool if there were folks in Hamilton or even over Isel who would say, I was drawn to Hamilton CRC because they cared deeply about me, only to discover when I got there, I was really drawn to their God and his son Jesus. See, in Jesus' mind, you are the closest thing to Jesus most people you meet this week are ever going to see. And you're a sinner, so am I. I understand that. But Jesus' way is to say, be like Abraham and Sarah. Find people who are in need and show them what I'm like. Run. Serve meat. Wash feet. Don't eat until they do. And if it takes 65 pounds, so be it. In March, Love in the Name of Christ, Northwest Allegan County, will celebrate its 20th anniversary. That's the vision of Love in the Name of Christ. Love in the Name of Christ does not exist to feed hungry people or to shelter homeless. Love in the Name of Christ exists to challenge the church to recognize strangers. In the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit, amen. Father, your son was an amazing teacher. Oh, he was our Messiah, our King, our Savior. We love him so much because we are born again, redeemed because of his blood. But this morning, we see him as our teacher. Thank you that he so cleverly and powerfully used his Bible to challenge his first century audience and through them his 21st century audience. To be like Abraham and Sarah and Boaz. To identify those around us, whether members or not, whose lives are in chaos. To be willing to be even countercultural, so that others may catch a glimpse of what the God of this community looks like. And may there be some, even this week, who, because of the way we treat them, who would be drawn to this community or that of the guests who are with us today, only to discover they are drawn to you and to your Son, Jesus. In the name of our Messiah, amen.